breakfast ice cream wala before we could answer. Mother gazed at me a little longer, with an expression that was both tender and perplexed. That was my introduction to interfaith dialogue. Father bought 3 ice cream sandwiches. We ate them in unusual silence as we continued on our Sunday walk. Chapter 24.
Ravi had a field day of it when he found out.
"So, Swami Jesus, will you go on the Hajj this year?"
he said, bringing the palms of his hands together in front of his face in a reverent namaskar.
"Does Mecca beckon?"
he crossed himself.
"Or will it be to Rome for your coronation as the next Pope Pius?"
He drew in the air a Greek letter, making clear the spelling of his mockery.
"Have you found time yet to get the end of your pecker cut off and become a Jew? At the rate you're going, if you go to temple on Thursday, mosque on Friday, synagogue on Saturday, and church on Sunday, you only need to convert to 3 more religions to be on holiday for the rest of your life."
And other lampoonery of such kind. Chapter 25.
And that wasn't the end of it. There are always those who take it upon themselves to defend God, as if ultimate reality, as if the sustaining frame of existence, were something weak and helpless. These people walk by a widow deformed by leprosy, begging for a few paisa, walk by children dressed in rags living in the street, and they think, business as usual. But if they perceive a slight against God, it is a different story. Their faces go red, their chests heave mightily, they sputter angry words. The degree of their indignation is astonishing. Their resolve is frightening. These people fail to realize that it is on the inside that God must be defended, not on the outside. They should direct their anger at themselves, for evil in the open is but evil from within that has been let out. The main battlefield for good is not the open ground of the public arena, but the small clearing of each heart. Meanwhile, the lot of widows and homeless children is very hard, and it is to their defense, not God's, that the self-righteous should rush. Once an oaf chased me away from the great mosque. When I went to church, the priest glared at me so that I could not feel the peace of Christ. A Brahmin sometimes shooed me away from darshan. My religious doings were reported to my parents in the hushed, urgent tones of treason revealed. As if this small-mindedness did God any good. To me, religion is about our dignity, not our depravity. I stopped attending Mass at Our Lady of Immaculate Conception and went instead to Our Lady of Angels. I no longer lingered after Friday prayer among my brethren. I went to temple at crowded times when the Brahmins were too distracted to come between God and me.
Chapter 26.
A few days after the meeting on the esplanade, I took my courage into my hands and went to see Father at his office.
Father?
Yes, Pisin?
I would like to be baptized, and I would like a prayer rug.
My words intruded slowly. He looked up from his papers after some seconds.
A what? What?
I would like to pray outside without getting my pants dirty. And I'm attending a Christian school without having received the proper baptism of Christ.
Why do you want to pray outside? In fact, why do you want to pray at all?
Because I love God.
Uh-huh.
He seemed taken aback by my answer, nearly embarrassed by it. There was a pause. I thought he was going to offer me ice cream again.
Well, Petit Seminaire is Christian only in name. There are many Hindu boys there who aren't Christians. You'll get just as good an education without being baptized, Praying to Allah won't make any difference either.
But I want to pray to Allah. I want to be a Christian.
You can't be both. You must be either one or the other.
Why can't I be both?
They're separate religions. They have nothing in common.
That's not what they say. They both claim Abraham is theirs. Muslims say the God of the Hebrews and Christians is the same as the God of the Muslims. They recognize David, Moses and Jesus as prophets.
What does this have to do with us, Piscine? We're Indians.
There have been Christians and Muslims in India for centuries. Some people say Jesus is buried in Kashmir.
He said nothing. Only looked at me. His brow furrowed. Suddenly, business called.
Talk to Mother about it.
She was reading.
Mother?
Yes, darling?
I would like to be baptized and I would like a prayer rug.
Talk to Father about it.
I did. He told me to talk to you about it.
Did he?
She laid her book down. She looked out in the direction of the zoo. At that moment, I'm sure Father felt a blow of chill air against the back of his neck. She turned to the bookshelf.
I have a book here that you'll like.
She already had her arm out, reaching for a volume. It was Robert Louis Stevenson. This was her usual tactic.
I've already read that, Mother. 3 times.
Oh.
Her arm hovered to the left.
The same with Conan Doyle,
I said. Her arm swung to the right.
R.K. Narayan? You can't possibly have read all of Narayan.
These matters are important to me, Mother.
Robinson Crusoe.
Mother.
But Piscine,
she said. She settled back into her chair, a path of least resistance look on her face, which meant I had to put up a stiff fight in precisely the right spots. She adjusted a cushion.
Father and I find your religious zeal a bit of a mystery.
It is a mystery.
I don't mean it that way. Listen, my darling, if you're going to be religious, you must be either a Hindu, a Christian, or a Muslim. You heard what they said on the Esplanade.
I don't see why I can't be all three. Mamaji has 2 passports. He's Indian and French. Why can't I be a Hindu, a Christian, and a Muslim?
That's different. France and India are nations on earth.
How many nations are there in the sky?
She thought for a second.
1. That's the point. 1 nation, 1 passport.
1 nation in the sky?
Yes, or none. There's that option too, you know. These are terribly old-fashioned things you've taken to.
If there's only 1 nation in the sky, shouldn't all passports be valid for it?
A cloud of uncertainty came over her face.
Bapu Gandhi said, yes, I know what Bapu Gandhi said.
She brought a hand to her forehead. She had a weary look, Mother did.
Good grief,
she said. Chapter 27. Later that evening, I overheard my parents speaking.
You said yes, said Father.
I believe he asked you to. You referred him to me,
replied Mother.
Did I?
You did.
I had a very busy day.
You're not busy now. You're quite comfortably unemployed by the looks of it. If you want to march into his room and pull the prayer rug from under his feet and discuss the question of Christian baptism with him, please go ahead. I won't object.
No, no.
I could tell from his voice that Father was settling deeper into his chair. There was a pause.
He seems to be attracting religions the way a dog attracts fleas, he pursued. I don't understand it. We're a modern Indian family. We live in a modern way. India is on the cusp of becoming a truly modern and advanced nation. And here we've produced a son who thinks he's the reincarnation of Sri Ramakrishna.
If Mrs. Gandhi is what being modern and advanced is about, I'm not sure I like it,
Mother said.
Mrs. Gandhi will pass. Progress is unstoppable. It is a drumbeat to which we must all march. Technology helps and good ideas spread. These are two laws of nature. If you don't let technology help you, if you resist good ideas, you condemn yourself to dinosaurhood. I am utterly convinced of this. Mrs. Gandhi and her foolishness will pass. The new India will come.
Indeed, she would pass. And the new India, or one family of it, would decide to move to Canada. Father went on.
Did you hear when he said, Bapu Gandhi said all religions are true?
Yes.
Bapu Gandhi? The boy is getting to be on affectionate terms with Gandhi? After Daddy Gandhi, what next? Uncle Jesus? And what's this nonsense? Has he really become a Muslim?
It seems so.
A Muslim? A devout Hindu, all right, I can understand. A Christian in addition, it's getting to be a bit strange, but I can stretch my mind. The Christians have been here for a long time. St. Thomas, St. Francis Xavier, the missionaries, and so on. We owe them good schools.
Yes.
So all that I can sort of accept. But Muslim? It's totally foreign to our tradition. They're outsiders.
They've been here a very long time, too. They're 100 times more numerous than the Christians.
That makes no difference. They're outsiders.
Perhaps Piseen is marching to a different drumbeat of progress.
You're defending the boy. You don't mind it that he's fancying himself a Muslim?
What can we do, Santosh? He's taken it to heart, and it's not doing anyone any harm. Maybe it's just a phase. It too may pass. Like Mrs. Gandhi.
Why can't he have the normal interests of a boy his age? Look at Ravi. All he can think about is cricket, movies and music.
You think that's better?
No, no. Oh, I don't know what to think. It's been a long day. He sighed. I wonder how far he'll go with these interests.
Mother chuckled.
Last week he finished a book called The Imitation of Christ.
The Imitation of Christ. I say again, I wonder how far he'll go with these interests, cried Father.
They laughed. Chapter 28. I loved my prayer rug. Ordinary in quality though it was, it glowed with beauty in my eyes. I'm sorry I lost it. Wherever I laid it, I felt special affection for the patch of ground beneath it and the immediate surroundings, which to me is a clear indication that it was a good prayer rug because it helped me remember that the earth is the creation of God and sacred the same all over. The pattern, in gold lines upon a background of red, was plain. A narrow rectangle with a triangular peak at one extremity to indicate the Qibla, the direction of prayer, and little curlicues floating around it, like wisps of smoke or accents from a strange language. The pile was soft. When I prayed, the short, unknotted tassels were inches from the tip of my forehead at one end of the carpet and inches from the tip of my toes at the other. A cozy size to make you feel at home anywhere upon this vast earth. I prayed outside because I liked it. Most often I unrolled my prayer rug in a corner of the yard behind the house. It was a secluded spot in the shade of a coral tree, next to a wall that was covered with bougainvillea. Along the length of the wall was a row of potted poinsettias. The bougainvillea had also crept through the tree. The contrast between its purple bracts and the red flowers of the tree was very pretty. And when that tree was in bloom, it was a regular aviary of crows, mynas, babblers, rosy pastors, sunbirds and parakeets. The wall was to my right, at a wide angle. Ahead of me, and to my left, beyond the milky mottled shade of the tree lay the sun-drenched open space of the yard. The appearance of things changed, of course, depending on the weather, the time of day, the time of year. But it's all very clear in my memory, as if it never changed. I faced Mecca with the help of a line I scratched into the pale yellow ground and carefully kept up. Sometimes, upon finishing my prayers, I would turn and catch sight of father or mother or Ravi observing me until they got used to the sight. My baptism was a slightly awkward affair. Mother played along nicely, father looked on stonily, and Ravi was mercifully absent because of a cricket match, which did not prevent him from commenting at great length on the event. The water trickled down my face and down my neck. Though just a beaker's worth, it had the refreshing effect of a monsoon rain.
Chapter 29.
Why do people move? What makes them uproot and leave everything they've known for a great unknown beyond the horizon? Why climb this Mount Everest of formalities that makes you feel like a beggar? Why enter this jungle of foreignness where everything is new, strange, and difficult? The answer is the same the world over. People move in the hope of a better life. The mid-1970s were troubled times in India. I gathered that from the deep furrows that appeared on Father's forehead when he read the papers, or from snippets of conversation that I caught between him and Mother and Mamaji and others. It's not that I didn't understand the drift of what they said, it's that I wasn't interested. The orangutans were as eager for chapatis as ever. The monkeys never asked after the news from Delhi. The rhinos and goats continued to live in peace. The birds twittered, the clouds carried rain, the sun was hot, the earth breathed. God was. There was no emergency in my world. Mrs. Gandhi finally got the best of father. In February 1976, the Tamil Nadu government was brought down by Delhi. It had been one of Mrs. Gandhi's most vocal critics. The takeover was smoothly enforced. Chief Minister Karunanidhi's ministry vanished quietly into resignation or house arrest. And what does the fall of one local government matter when the whole country's constitution has been suspended these last 8 months? But it was to father the crowning touch in Mrs. Gandhi's dictatorial takeover of the nation. The camel at the zoo was unfazed, but that straw broke father's back. He shouted, "Soon she'll come down to our zoo and tell us that her jails are full. She needs more space. Could we put Desai with the lions?" Morarji Desai was an opposition politician, no friend of Mrs. Gandhi's. It makes me sad, my father's ceaseless worrying. Mrs. Gandhi could have personally bombed the zoo. It would have been fine with me if father had been gay about it. I wish he hadn't fretted so much. It's hard on a son to see his father sick with worry. But worry he did. Any business is risky business, and none more so than small bee business, the one that risks the shirt on its back. A zoo is a cultural institution. Like a public library, like a museum, it is at the service of popular education and science. And by this token, not much of a money-making venture, for the greater good and the greater profit are not compatible aims, much to father's chagrin. The truth was, we were not a rich family, certainly not by Canadian standards. We were a poor family that happened to own a lot of animals, though not the roof above their heads, or above ours for that matter. The life of a zoo, like the life of its inhabitants in the wild, is precarious. It is neither big enough a business to be above the law, nor small enough to survive on its margins. To prosper, a zoo needs parliamentary government, democratic elections, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of association, rule of law, and everything else enshrined in India's constitution. Impossible to enjoy the animals otherwise. Long term, bad politics is bad for business. People move because of the wear and tear of anxiety, because of the gnawing feeling that no matter how hard they work, their efforts will yield nothing, that what they build up in 1 year will be torn down in 1 day by others,
because of the impression that the future is blocked up, that they might do all right, but not their children. Because of the feeling that nothing will change, that happiness and prosperity are possible only somewhere else. The new India split to pieces and collapsed in father's mind. Mother assented. We would bolt. It was announced to us one evening during dinner. Ravi and I were thunderstruck. Canada. If Andhra Pradesh, just north of us, was alien, if Sri Lanka, a monkey's hop across the strait, was the dark side of the moon, imagine what Canada was. Canada meant absolutely nothing to us. It was like Timbuktu, by definition, a place permanently far away. Chapter 30. He's married. I'm bent down, taking my shoes off, when I hear him say, "I would like you to meet my wife." I look up, and there beside him is Mrs. Patel.
"Hello,"
she says, extending her hand and smiling.
"Pisin has been telling me lots about you."
I can't say the same of her. I had no idea. She's on her way out, so we talk only a few minutes. She's also Indian, but has a more typically Canadian accent. She must be second generation. She's a little younger than him, skin slightly darker, long black hair woven in a tress, bright dark eyes and lovely white teeth. She has in her arms a dry-cleaned white lab coat in a protective plastic film. She's a pharmacist. When I say, "Nice meeting you, Mrs. Patel," she replies,
"Please, make it Mina."
After a quick kiss between husband and wife, she's off on a working Saturday. This house is more than a box full of icons. I start noticing small signs of conjugal existence. They were there all along, but I hadn't seen them because I wasn't looking for them. He's a shy man. Life has taught him not to show off what is most precious to him. Is she the nemesis of my digestive tract?
"I've made a special chutney for you," he says. He's smiling. No, he is.
Chapter 31. They met once, Mr. and Mr. Kumar, the baker and the teacher. The first Mr. Kumar had expressed the wish to see the zoo.
"All these years, and I've never seen it. It's so close by, too. Will you show it to me?"
he asked.
"Yes, of course," I replied. "It would be an honor."
We agreed to meet at the main gate the next day after school. I worried all that day. I scolded myself.
"You fool! Why did you see the main gate? At any time there will be a crowd of people there. Have you forgotten how plain he looks? You'll never recognize him."
If I walked by him without seeing him, he would be hurt. He would think I had changed my mind and didn't want to be seen with a poor Muslim baker. He could leave without saying a word. He wouldn't be angry. He would accept my claims that it was the sun in my eyes, but he wouldn't want to come to the zoo anymore. I could see it happening that way. I had to recognize him. I would hide and wait until I was certain it was him. That's what I would do. But I had noticed before that it was when I tried my hardest to recognize him that I was least able to pick him out. The very effort seemed to blind me. At the appointed hour, I stood squarely before the main gate of the zoo and started rubbing my eyes with both hands.
"What are you doing?"
It was Raj, a friend.
"I'm busy."
"You're busy rubbing your eyes?
Go away.
Let's go to Beach Road."
"I'm waiting for someone."
"Well, you'll miss him if you keep rubbing your eyes like that."
"Thank you for the information. Have fun on Beach Road."
"How about Government Park?"
"I can't, I tell you."
"Come on.
Please, Raj, move on.
He left. I went back to rubbing my eyes.
Will you help me with my homework, Pai?
It was Ajit, another friend.
Later. Go away.
Hello, Piseen.
It was Mrs. Radhakrishna, a friend of Mother's. In a few more words, I eased her on her way.
Excuse me, where's La Porte Street?
A stranger.
That way.
How much is admission to the zoo?
Another stranger.
5 rupees. The ticket booth is right there.
Has the chlorine got to your eyes? It was Mamaji.
Hello, Mamaji. No, it hasn't.
Is your father around?
I think so.
See you tomorrow morning.
Yes, Mamaji.
I am here, Piseen.
My hands froze over my eyes. That voice. Strange in a familiar way. Familiar in a strange way. I felt a smile welling up in me.
Salaam alaikum, Mr. Kumar. How good to see you.
Wa alaikum assalam. Is something wrong with your eyes?
No, nothing. Just a bit of dust.
They look quite red. It's nothing.
He headed for the ticket booth, but I called him back.
No, no, not for you, master.
It was with pride that I waved the ticket collector's hand away and showed Mr. Kumar into the zoo. He marveled at everything. At how to tall trees came tall giraffes. How carnivores were supplied with herbivores and herbivores with grass. How some creatures crowded the day and others the night. How some that needed sharp beaks had sharp beaks, and others that needed limber limbs had limber limbs. It made me happy that he was so impressed. He quoted from the Holy Quran.
In all this there are messages indeed for a people who use their reason.
We came to the zebras. Mr. Kumar had never heard of such creatures, let alone seen one. He was dumbfounded.
They're called zebras,
I said.
Have they been painted with a brush?
No, no. They look like that naturally.
What happens when it rains?
Nothing.
The stripes don't melt?
No.
I had brought some carrots. There was one left. A large and sturdy specimen. I took it out of the bag. At that moment, I heard a slight scraping of gravel to my right. It was Mr. Kumar, coming up to the railing in his usual limping and rolling gait.
Hello, sir.
Hello, Pai. The baker, a shy but dignified man, nodded at the teacher, who nodded back. An alert zebra had noticed my carrot and had come up to the low fence. It twitched its ears and stamped the ground softly. I broke the carrot in two and gave one half to Mr. Kumar and one half to Mr. Kumar.
Thank you, Piseen,
said one.
Thank you, Pai,
said the other. Mr. Kumar went first, dipping his hand over the fence. The zebra's thick, strong, black lips grasped the carrot eagerly. Mr. Kumar wouldn't let go. The zebra sank its teeth into the carrot and snapped it in two. It crunched loudly on the treat for a few seconds, then reached for the remaining piece, lips flowing over Mr. Kumar's fingertips. He released the carrot and touched the zebra's soft nose. It was Mr. Kumar's turn. He wasn't so demanding of the zebra. Once it had his half of the carrot between its lips, he let go. The lips hurriedly moved the carrot into the mouth. Mr. and Mr. Kumar looked delighted.
A zebra, you say?
Said Mr. Kumar.
That's right,
I replied.
It belongs to the same family as the ass and the horse.
The Rolls-Royce of equids, said Mr. Kumar.
What a wondrous creature,
said Mr. Kumar.
This one's a Grant's zebra, I said.
Mr. Kumar said, Equis Barcelli Bohemi.
Mr. Kumar said,
Allahu Akbar.
I said, It's very pretty. We looked on. Chapter 32.
There are many examples of animals coming to surprising living arrangements. All are instances of that animal equivalent of anthropomorphism. Zoomorphism, where an animal takes a human being or another animal to be one of its kind. The most famous case is also the most common. The pet dog, which has so assimilated humans into the realm of doghood as to want to mate with them, a fact that any dog owner who has had to pull an amorous dog from the leg of a mortified visitor will confirm. Our golden agouti and spotted packer got along very well, contentedly huddling together and sleeping against each other until the first was stolen. I have already mentioned our rhinoceros and goatherd and the case of circus lions. There are confirmed stories of drowning sailors being pushed up to the surface of the water and held there by dolphins, a characteristic way in which these marine mammals help each other. A case is mentioned in the literature of a stoat and a rat living in a companion relationship, while other rats presented to the stoat were devoured by it in the typical way of stoats. We had our own case of the freak suspension of the predator-prey relationship. We had a mouse that lived for several weeks with the vipers. While other mice dropped in the terrarium disappeared within 2 days, this little brown Methuselah built itself a nest, stored the grains we gave it in various hideaways, and scampered about in plain sight of the snakes. We were amazed. We put up a sign to bring the mouse to the public's attention. It finally met its end in a curious way. A young viper bit it. Was the viper unaware of the mouse's special status? Unsocialized to it, perhaps. Whatever the case, the mouse was bitten by a young viper, but devoured, and immediately, by an adult. If there was a spell, it was broken by the young one. Things returned to normal after that. All mice disappeared down the viper's gullets at the usual rate. In the trade, dogs are sometimes used as foster mothers for lion cubs. Though the cubs grow to become larger than their caregiver and far more dangerous, they never give their mother trouble, and she never loses her placid behavior or her sense of authority over her litter. Signs have to be put up to explain to the public that the dog is not live food left for the lions, just as we had to put up a sign pointing out that rhinoceros are herbivores and do not eat goats. What could be the explanation for zoomorphism? Can't a rhinoceros distinguish big from small, tough hide from soft fur? Isn't it plain to a dolphin what a dolphin is like? I believe the answer lies in something I mentioned earlier. That measure of madness that moves life in strange but saving ways. The golden agouti, like the rhinoceros, was in need of companionship. The circus lions don't care to know that their leader is a weakling human. The fiction guarantees their social well-being and staves off violent anarchy. As for the lion cubs, they would positively keel over with fright if they knew their mother was a dog, for that would mean they were motherless, the absolute worst condition imaginable for any young, warm-blooded life. I'm sure even the adult viper, as it swallowed the mouse, must have felt somewhere in its undeveloped mind a twinge of regret, a feeling that something greater was just missed, an imaginative leap away from the lonely, crude reality of a reptile.
Chapter 33. He shows me family memorabilia. Wedding photos first. A Hindu wedding with Canada prominently on the edges. A younger him, a younger her. They went to Niagara Falls for their honeymoon. had a lovely time. Smiles to prove it. We move back in time. Photos from his student days at U of T, with friends, in front of St. Mike's, in his room, during Diwali on Gerrard Street, reading at St. Basil's Church, dressed in a white gown, wearing another kind of white gown in a lab of the zoology department, on graduation day. A smile every time, but his eyes tell another story. Photos from Brazil, with plenty of three-toed sloths in situ. With a turn of a page, we jump over the Pacific, and there is next to nothing. He tells me that the camera did click regularly, on all the usual important occasions, but everything was lost. What little there is consists of what was assembled by Mamaji and mailed over after the events. There is a photo taken at the zoo during the visit of a VIP. In black and white, another world is revealed to me. The photo is crowded with people. A union cabinet minister is the focus of attention. There's a giraffe in the background. Near the edge of the group, I recognize a younger Mr. Adirubasami. Mamaji? I ask, pointing. Yes, he says. There's a man next to the minister, with horn-rimmed glasses and hair very cleanly combed. He looks like a plausible Mr. Patel, face rounder than his son's. Is this your father? I ask. He shakes his head.
I don't know who that is.
There's a pause of a few seconds. He says,
It's my father who took the picture.
On the same page, there's another group shot, mostly of school children. He taps the photo.
That's Richard Barker, he says.
I'm amazed. I look closely, trying to extract personality from appearance. Unfortunately, it's black and white again and a little out of focus. A photo taken in better days, casually. Richard Parker is looking away. He doesn't even realize that his picture is being taken. The opposing page is entirely taken up by a color photo of the swimming pool of the Aurobindo Ashram. It's a nice big outdoor pool with clear, sparkling water, a clean blue bottom, and an attached diving pool. The next page features a photo of the front gate of Petit Seminaire School. An arch has the school's motto painted on it. Nil magnum nisi bonum. No greatness without goodness. And that's it. An entire childhood memorialized in four nearly irrelevant photographs. He grows somber.
The worst of it, he says, is that I can hardly remember what my mother looks like anymore. I can see her in my mind, but it's fleeting. As soon as I try to have a good look at her, she fades. It's the same with her voice. If I saw her again in the street, it would all come back. But that's not likely to happen. It's very sad not to remember what your mother looks like.
He closes the book. Chapter 34.
Father said, We'll sail like Columbus.
He was hoping to find India,
I pointed out sullenly.
We sold the zoo, lock, stock and barrel. To a new country, a new life. Besides assuring our collection of a happy future, the transaction would pay for our immigration and leave us with a good sum to make a fresh start in Canada. Though now, when I think of it, the sum is laughable. How blinded we are by money. We would have sold our animals to zoos in India, but American zoos were willing to pay higher prices. CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, had just come into effect, and the window on the trading of captured wild animals had slammed shut. The future of zoos would now lie with other zoos.
The Pondicherry Zoo closed shop at just the right time. There was a scramble to buy our animals. The final buyers were a number of zoos, mainly the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago and the soon-to-open Minnesota Zoo. But odd animals were going to Los Angeles, Louisville, Oklahoma City, and Cincinnati. And two animals were being shipped to the Canada Zoo. That's how Ravi and I felt. We did not want to go. We did not want to live in a country of gale-force winds and -200-degree winters. Canada was not on the cricket map. Departure was made easier, as far as getting us used to the idea, by the time it took for all the pre-departure preparations. It took well over a year. I don't mean for us. I mean for the animals. Considering that animals dispense with clothes, footwear, linen, furniture, kitchenware, toiletries, that nationality means nothing to them, that they care not a jot for passports, money, employment prospects, schools, cost of housing, healthcare facilities, considering, in short, their lightness of being, it's amazing how hard it is to move them. Moving a zoo is like moving a city. The paperwork was colossal. Liters of water used up in the wetting of stamps. Dear Mr. So-and-so, written hundreds of times. Offers made, sighs heard, doubts expressed, haggling gone through, decisions sent higher up for approval, prices agreed upon, deals clinched, dotted lines signed, congratulations given, certificates of origin sought, certificates of health sought, export permits sought, import permits sought, quarantine regulations clarified, transportation organized, a fortune spent on telephone calls. It's a joke in the zoo business, a weary joke, that the paperwork involved in trading a shrew weighs more than an elephant, that the paperwork involved in trading an elephant weighs more than a whale, and that you must never try to trade a whale, never. There seemed to be a single file of nitpicking bureaucrats from Pondicherry to Minneapolis via Delhi and Washington, each with his form, his problem, his hesitation. Shipping the animals to the moon couldn't possibly have been more complicated. Father pulled nearly every hair off his head and came close to giving up on a number of occasions. There were surprises. Most of our birds and reptiles, and our lemurs, rhinos, orangutans, mandrills, lion-tailed macaques, giraffes, anteaters, tigers, leopards, cheetahs, hyenas, zebras, Himalayan and sloth bears, Indian elephants and Nilgiri tars, among others, were in demand. But others, Elfie, for example, were met with silence.
"A cataract operation,"
Father shouted, waving the letter.
"They'll take her if we do a cataract operation on her right eye. On a hippopotamus. What next? Nose job on the rhinos?"
Some of our other animals were considered too common. The lions and baboons, for example. Father judiciously traded these for an extra orangutan from the Mysore Zoo and a chimpanzee from the Manila Zoo. As for Elfie, she lived out the rest of her days at the Trivandrum Zoo. One zoo asked for an authentic Brahmin cow for their children's zoo. Father walked out into the urban jungle of Pondicherry and bought a cow with dark, wet eyes, a nice fat hump, and horns so straight and at such right angles to its head that it looked as if it had licked an electrical outlet. Father had its horns painted bright orange and little plastic bells fitted to the tips for added authenticity. A deputation of three Americans came. I was very curious. I had never seen real live Americans. They were pink, fat, friendly, very competent, and sweated profusely. They examined our animals. They put most of them to sleep and then applied stethoscopes to hearts, examined urine and feces as if horoscopes, drew blood in syringes and analyzed it, fondled humps and bumps, tapped teeth, blinded eyes with flashlights, pinched skins, stroked and pulled hairs. Poor animals. They must have thought they were being drafted into the U.S. Army.
We got big smiles from the Americans and bone-crushing handshakes. The result was that the animals, like us, got their working papers. They were future Yankees, and we, future Canucks.
Chapter 35.
We left Madras on June 21st, 1977, on the Panamanian-registered Japanese cargo ship, Simsum. Her officers were Japanese, her crew was Taiwanese, and she was large and impressive. On our last day in Pondicherry, I said goodbye to Mamaji, to Mr. and Mr. Kumar, to all my friends, and even to many strangers. Mother was apparelled in her finest sari. Her long tress, artfully folded back and attached to the back of her head, was adorned with a garland of fresh jasmine flowers. She looked beautiful and sad, for she was leaving India, India of the heat and monsoons, of rice fields and the Kaveri River, of coastlines and stone temples, of bullock carts and colourful trucks, of friends and known shopkeepers, of Nehru Street and Guber Salai, of this and that, India so familiar to her and loved by her. While her men, I fancied myself one already, though I was only 16, were in a hurry to get going, were Winnipeggers at heart already, she lingered. The day before our departure, she pointed at a cigarette wala and earnestly asked,
"Should we get a pack or two?"
Father replied, "They have tobacco in Canada. And why do you want to buy cigarettes? We don't smoke." "Yes, they have tobacco in Canada. But do they have gold flake cigarettes? Do they have Arun ice cream? Are the bicycles heroes? Are the televisions Onidas? Are the cars ambassadors? Are the bookshops Higginbottoms?" Such, I suspect, were the questions that swirled in Mother's mind as she contemplated buying cigarettes. Animals were sedated, cages were loaded and secured, feed was stored, bunks were assigned, lines were tossed, and whistles were blown. As the ship was worked out of the dock and piloted out to sea, I wildly waved goodbye to India. The sun was shining, the breeze was steady, and seagulls shrieked in the air above us. I was terribly excited. Things didn't turn out the way they were supposed to. But what can you do? You must take life the way it comes at you, and make the best of it.
Chapter 36. The cities are large and memorably crowded in India, but when you leave them, you travel through vast stretches of country where hardly a soul is to be seen. I remember wondering where 950 million Indians could be hiding. I could say the same of his house. I'm a little early. I've just set foot on the cement steps of the front porch when a teenager bursts out the front door. He's wearing a baseball uniform and carrying baseball equipment, and he's in a hurry. When he sees me, he stops dead in his tracks, startled. He turns around and hollers into the house.
"Dad, the writer's here!"
To me, he says,
"Hi,"
and rushes off. His father comes to the front door. "Hello," he says. "That was your son?" I ask, incredulous. "Yes." To acknowledge the fact brings a smile to his lips. "I'm sorry you didn't meet properly. He's late for practice. His name is Nikhil. He goes by Nick." I'm in the entrance hall. "I didn't know you had a son," I say. There's a barking. A small mongrel mutt, black and brown, races up to me, panting and sniffing. He jumps up against my legs. "Or a dog," I add.
"He's friendly. Tata, down."
Tata ignores him. I hear,
"Hello,"
Only this greeting is not short and forceful like Nick's. It's a long, nasal and softly whining, "Hello!" with the "Ooh!" reaching for me like a tap on the shoulder or a gentle tug at my pants. I turn. Leaning against the sofa in the living room, looking up at me bashfully, is a little brown girl, pretty in pink, very much at home. She's holding an orange cat in her arms. Two front legs sticking straight up and a deeply sunk head are all that is visible of it above her crossed arms. The rest of the cat is hanging all the way down to the floor. The animal seems quite relaxed about being stretched on the rack in this manner. "And this is your daughter," I say.
"Yes, Usha. Usha, darling, are you sure Moccasin is comfortable like that?"
Usha drops Moccasin. He flops to the floor, unperturbed.
"Hello, Usha," I say.
She comes up to her father and peeks at me from behind his leg.
"What are you doing, little one?" he says. "Why are you hiding?"
She doesn't reply, only looks at me with a smile and hides her face.
"How old are you, Usha?" I ask.
She doesn't reply. Then Piscine Molitor Patel, known to all as Pi Patel, bends down and picks up his daughter.
"You know the answer to that question, You're 4 years old. 1, 2, 3, 4.
At each number, he softly presses the tip of her nose with his index finger. She finds this terribly funny. She giggles and buries her face in the crook of his neck. This story has a happy ending. Part 2. The Pacific Ocean. Chapter 37.
The ship sank. It made a sound like a monstrous metallic burp. Things bubbled at the surface and then vanished. Everything was screaming. The sea, the wind, my heart. From the lifeboat, I saw something in the water. I cried,
"Richard Parker? Is that you? It's so hard to see. Oh, that this rain would stop. Richard Parker? Richard Parker? Yes, it is you."
I could see his head. He was struggling to stay at the surface of the water.
"Jesus, Mary, Muhammad and Vishnu, how good to see you, Richard Parker. Don't give up, please. Come to the lifeboat. Do you hear this whistle? Tree, tree, tree. You heard right. Swim, swim. You're a strong swimmer. It's not 100 feet.
He had seen me. He looked panic-stricken. He started swimming my way. The water about him was shifting wildly. He looked small and helpless.
"Richard Parker, can you believe what has happened to us? Tell me it's a bad dream. Tell me it's not real. Tell me I'm still in my bunk on the Simsum and I'm tossing and turning and soon I'll wake up from this nightmare. Tell me I'm still happy. Mother, my tender guardian angel of wisdom, where are you? And you, Father, my loving worrywart. And you, Ravi, dazzling hero of my childhood. Vishnu, preserve me. Allah, protect me. Christ, save me. I can't bear it. Tree, tree, tree."
I was not wounded in any part of my body, but I had never experienced such intense pain, such a ripping of the nerves, such an ache of the heart. He would not make it. He would drown. He was hardly moving forward, and his movements were weak. His nose and mouth kept dipping under water. Only his eyes were steadily on me.
"What are you doing, Richard Parker? Don't you love life? Keep swimming then. Tree, tree, tree. Kick with your legs. Kick, kick, kick."
He stirred in the water and made to swim.
"And what of my extended family? birds, beasts and reptiles. They too have drowned. Every single thing I value in life has been destroyed, and I am allowed no explanation. I am to suffer hell without any account from heaven.
In that case, what is the purpose of reason, Richard Parker? Is it no more than to shine at practicalities? The getting of food, clothing and shelter? Why can't reason give greater answers? Why can we throw a question further than we can pull in an answer? Why such a vast net if there's so little fish to catch?
His head was barely above water. He was looking up, taking in the sky one last time. There was a life buoy in the boat with a rope tied to it. I took hold of it and waved it in the air.
Do you see this life buoy, Richard Parker? Do you see it? Catch hold of it. Humph! I'll try again. Humph!
He was too far. But the sight of the life buoy flying his way gave him hope. He revived and started beating the water with vigorous, desperate strokes.
That's right. One, two. One, two. One, two. Breathe when you can. Watch for the waves. Three, three, three.
My heart was chilled to ice. I felt ill with grief. But there was no time for frozen shock. It was shock in activity. Something in me did not want to give up on life, was unwilling to let go, wanted to fight to the very end. Where that part of me got the heart, I don't know.
Isn't it ironic, Richard Parker? We're in hell, yet still we're afraid of immortality. Look how close you are. Tree, tree, tree! Hurrah, hurrah! You made it, Richard Parker, you made it! Catch!
I threw the life buoy mightily. It fell in the water right in front of him. With his last energies, he stretched forward and took hold of it.
Hold on tight. I'll pull you in. Don't let go. Pull with your eyes while I pull with my hands. In a few seconds, you'll be aboard and we'll be together.
Wait a second. Together? We'll be together? Have I gone mad? I woke up to what I was doing. I yanked on the rope.
Let go of that life buoy, Richard Parker. Let go, I said. I don't want you here, do you understand? Go somewhere else. Leave me alone. Get lost. Drown. Drown.
He was kicking vigorously with his legs. I grabbed an oar. I thrust it at him, meaning to push him away. I missed and lost hold of the oar. I grabbed another oar. I dropped it in an oarlock and pulled as hard as I could, meaning to move the lifeboat away. All I accomplished was to turn the lifeboat a little, bringing one end closer to Richard Parker. I would hit him on the head. I lifted the oar in the air. He was too fast. He reached up and pulled himself aboard.
Oh my God!
Ravi was right. Truly, I was to be the next goat. I had a wet, trembling, half-drowned, heaving and coughing 3-year-old adult Bengal tiger in my lifeboat. Richard Parker rose unsteadily to his feet on the tarpaulin, eyes blazing as they met mine, ears laid tight to his head, all weapons drawn. His head was the size and color of the life buoy, with teeth. I turned around, stepped over the zebra, and threw myself overboard. Chapter 38. I don't understand. For days the ship had pushed on, bullishly indifferent to its surroundings. The sun shone, rain fell, winds blew, currents flowed, the sea built up hills, the sea dug up valleys. The Simsum did not care. It moved with the slow, massive confidence of a continent. I had bought a map of the world for the trip. I had set it up in our cabin against a cork billboard. Every morning, I got our position from the control bridge and marked it on the map with an orange-tipped pin. We sailed from Madras, across the Bay of Bengal, down through the Strait of Malacca, around Singapore, and up to Manila. I loved every minute of it. It was a thrill to be on a ship. Taking care of the animals kept us very busy. Every night we fell into bed weary to our bones.